In the coming week, the U.S. COVID-19 death count is projected to reach 500,000. The Biden administration formally rejoins the Paris Climate Agreement, and President Biden addresses the Munich Security Conference. It's February 18th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, it looks clear that by this weekend, the United States will hit 500,000 coronavirus-related deaths. It's hard to believe that it was just about a year ago when you and I first started discussing what was being called the mysterious pneumonia-like virus in Wuhan, China. The Biden administration has been moving to vigorously roll out vaccination plans. Can you give us an update, though, on where that stands and what the projections are at this point about how many shots we'll be getting into arms by, say, the summertime?
Sure, Bob. Let's begin with the initial pledge that President Biden made, and that was to vaccinate 100 million Americans in his first 100 days in office. That goal was actually criticized by a number of public health experts on the grounds that it wasn't ambitious enough. At the end of January, the Biden administration upped its target goal to vaccinating 150 million people in his first 100 days in office. And just this week, President Biden said that we should have enough vaccines available for all Americans by the end of July. That doesn't necessarily mean that all Americans will be vaccinated by the end of July. More on that in a moment. But where we stand right now, the United States is vaccinating something on the order of 1.6 million people a day. And so far, about 40 million Americans, or about 12% of the population, have received at least one shot. Keep in mind the two vaccines currently on the market in the United States, the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine, both require two shots for maximum effectiveness. And about 16 million Americans, which I think is something on the order of 5% of the population, has been fully vaccinated. There's also some other good news out there. One is that Johnson & Johnson's one-shot vaccine is likely to be approved by the FDA later this month. Not only will it provide extra supply of vaccine, but Johnson & Johnson's one-shot vaccine doesn't require the kind of refrigeration capabilities that the Moderna and particularly the Pfizer vaccine require, so it's easier to handle and distribute. We're also seeing that the percentage of Americans saying they are willing to get a shot is going up. And perhaps the best news in recent days is that the seven-day moving average of cases is down nearly 60% since it peaked in mid-January. So right now we're going sort of into a lull in the infection rate in the country. Doesn't mean we're out of the woods yet. Doesn't mean that the numbers can't go back up. But certainly compared to middle of January, we're in a better spot as a country.
And Jim, on top of those positive trends, looks like there's the biggest movement yet towards bringing students back into school, at least part-time. So we'll see if that momentum holds. But I have to say, Jim, what is the bad news part of these developments that you've been seeing?
Well, one piece of bad news, Bob, you've already mentioned, which is that the death toll in the United States is soon to cross the 500,000 mark. Just to put that in perspective, that's a larger number of deaths than the United States suffered during World War II. Related to that is the fact that the United States has one of the worst per capita death rates from COVID-19 in the world. It stands right now at about 1,500 people for every million Americans. Now, that's not as bad as the United Kingdom, which is topping 1,700 deaths per million, but it's 27 times higher rate than you see in Japan and 50 times the rate you see in South Korea. So clearly some countries have had the capacity to get the virus under control. There's also a lot of disturbing numbers coming out about the death toll varying across different demographic groups. It is pretty clear that the death toll is higher among Blacks and Latinos. Now, when you look at vaccinations, we only have partial data, but again, you see the same sort of racial and ethnic differences. Latinos and Blacks lag behind the rest of the population in terms of getting vaccinated. And then, of course, there's this big concern about the virus mutating. In some ways, Bob, we're sort of seeing Darwinian law playing out before us. The viruses are mutating. The mutations that make the virus more likely to replicate are taking hold. And we've seen a variety of these. We've talked about the UK variant, the South Africa variant, the Brazil variant. But I want to point out that it's not just that the vaccines are mutating overseas, they're also mutating here at home. And studies have shown there are now at least seven different variants taking hold here in the United States. And again, a lot of work has to be done to nail some of these things down. But the belief is that, number one, these variants are more infectious. That is, they're easier to spread. They're possibly more lethal. That is, if you get it, you're more likely to get very sick and to die. And then, of course, there are unknown questions about how these new strains will test our existing vaccine supply. The AstraZeneca vaccine that was developed in Britain has been used in South Africa, and it appears not to be effective against the South African variant. So on that score, I think various companies producing vaccines are trying to test what they are producing against these different variants. And a lot of that work initially takes place in the lab, but the real test obviously happens in the real world. One last thing, Bob, just on the bad news front is that while the United States is beginning to vaccinate, Britain is beginning to vaccinate, European Union is beginning to vaccinate, China and the rest, you know, if you look at the world's 130 poorest countries, they don't have any COVID-19 vaccine. And indeed, low and middle income countries aren't really expecting their first vaccine shipments to arrive until next month. And it's going to be a long process to get people overseas vaccinated. There's an international organization designed to promote that known as COVAX, and it's hoping to deliver at least 2 billion doses. But obviously, we are a planet of some 7 billion people. That matters, not just because of the human toll in these individual countries, but as long as the virus remains uncontrolled, you have more opportunities for mutations, the emergence of new strains, which, as we've seen, can be much more deadly, which is why I think a lot of people in the public health sphere, Bob, are thinking about COVID-19 now as shifting to an endemic phase. That is, it's something that we're going to have to deal with for quite a while. And that could be troubling, and it's going to have continuing significant consequences, both for the global economy, but also for the way we all live our lives.
Yeah, and then you're also seeing this ongoing discussion of what we call vaccine diplomacy, where you have other countries developing their vaccines, maybe less celebrated and, let's say, less vetted in some cases. I'm thinking of China and Russia, but they are offering their vaccines to other countries, and other countries are starting to take them up on it. So I'm thinking about Sinopharm's vaccine or the one that's called Sputnik by Russia. So that'll be interesting to watch, and the extent to which there is an international effort that corrals or coordinates all of these and gets them out in a coordinated way, it's still really, it feels really choppy right now. And as you see the anecdotal reports just around the U.S., it can be maddeningly frustrating, on top of which you have winter weather that's impeding the rollout. So yeah, as you say, Jim, a very long road to go and a kind of, I think, a change in our thinking about how this is going to be part of our lives.
Well, you're quite right, Bob, that trying to vaccinate not millions, but billions of people is a massive logistical headache. And I know there's a lot of talk about framing these vaccines as sort of a national competition, the Russians against the Chinese, against the British, against the Americans. But the reality is that we want more vaccines. We want to get more shots in the arms of more people, precisely because of this concern about the evolution of the virus. Because again, if people aren't vaccinated, they become incubators for the virus. It mutates. You suddenly get a new strain that may defy the vaccines that we already have. So I would view Russian success, Chinese success, American success in vaccine production as a win for everyone concerned. But let's switch gears, Bob, and talk about another transnational problem, and that's climate change. On his first day in office, President Biden signed an executive order re-entering the United States into the Paris Climate Agreement. This, of course, was something that Biden pledged to do during his campaign. And in the coming week, the United States is going to formally re-enter the agreement. How have allies responded to the Biden administration's decision to rejoin Paris?
Well, I would say in general, favorably, although warily. It must be said, first of all, that the Biden administration's envoy, John Kerry, is well known to international climate negotiators and interlocutors. And so that was certainly greeted, as well as the U.S. just being back in the discussion. It was by stepping away and by essentially dismissing the global effort, at least on the federal level, the U.S. move under the Trump administration really seemed to just slow down any sort of momentum that had been building under the the Obama administration's, particularly which involved sort of the U.S.-China pledges to cut emissions and so forth. So you have now administration that's at least so far making the right sounds on this. But again, the kind of the whiplash concern of U.S. allies is such that they want to kind of just sort of see what the steps are and then continue to treat them warily because of the U.S. election cycle and so forth. I will say, though, that you are going to start to see a ramp up in discussions. There's going to be preparations for this year-end major conference on climate change known as COP26.
This is the one in Glasgow?
This is the one in Glasgow. On top of that, there have been a number of countries that have been pledging net zero emissions by 2050. And you can add to that the United States, at least according to the Biden administration's climate plans. And so, as I say, there's some momentum, while at the same time ongoing, and we discuss this almost every week, signs that the increase in emissions since Paris was signed in 2015 and the extreme weather instances that we're seeing continue to mount. And it's really going to take strenuous efforts and really move towards these net zero emissions type pledges that are sincere and that are impactful to make any sort of dent into the goals of keeping global warming to a level below 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that's something that's seen as really daunting right now. It's also a little bit sort of incongruous as we discuss this major polar vortex that's gripping not only the US, but you're seeing, you know, photos of snowfall in Jerusalem and all sorts of photos across Europe of deep freeze. And yet there are anomalies going on. The fact that the state of Texas has had this incredibly cold weather that's knocked out power and so forth. All of these are signs of unusual weather that's going to start to become more of a norm and going to require improved efforts at sustainability, at what they call resilience in the face of inevitable climate changes, regardless of the steps that are taken in diplomatic quarters.
So, Bob, the Biden administration is committing itself to doing something about climate change. It's committed itself to reducing U.S. emissions, but it also intends to persuade other countries, particularly China, to reduce their emissions. What specifically is the Biden administration going to do, especially given that, at least on the domestic front, faces a pretty big constraint? It's unlikely to be able to get any major climate change legislation through the U.S. Congress, given how narrowly power is divided in the Senate.
Congress is going to be the toughest area, obviously, and it's going to try to have to build support. I think what you'll see is, first of all, in the area of the possible, that the U.S. could start to contribute again towards the Global Climate Fund. It had pledged at Paris to contribute something like $3 billion towards that, and this is helping developing countries in some places to help meet their goals. It's, I guess, boosting the efforts of state and local governments that, despite the federal government dropping out of the Paris Agreement, have pledged to stay and be a part of it. So you had more than 600 local governments with pretty detailed climate action plans that include emission reduction targets. And these are governments that were sending representative states and some cities sending representatives to global climate meetings. You have major firms that are starting to signal that they're in on this. Renewable energy continues to grow in the U.S. And so I think there's ways it can incentivize renewable energy growth. And then you have shortly after the Biden administration announced it was rejoining Paris, you had the CEO of General Motors announcing they were going to go all electric in about a decade. So I think it's partly kind of using the pulpit of the White House to rally this, to take note of it, to repeatedly say that it is actually a real issue that requires U.S. to take charge. You see surveys of Americans that indicate increasing number of American rank and file Americans, so to speak, who see climate as a concern. And so if the government continues to repeat this and sort of lays out a plan, a blueprint, the hope is that it can build some momentum for when a climate legislation package comes before Congress, that people who are typically against this, many Republican lawmakers have been against strong climate legislation, maybe they'll hear more from their constituents that maybe it's not a good idea and they can get a critical mass of support. That's the hope for plan, Jim. But there's a lot of different elements going on. I would say the energy one is the more compelling one at the moment because renewables do seem to be a real thing.
And I will note that the problems that the great state of Texas is suffering this week with its failing electrical grid isn't really about renewable and relying on wind power in particular, but because they did not build an electrical grid that was resilient, because they had failures not just with wind turbines freezing up, but with natural gas and coal-fired plants also not working as well. And I think this touches on something that's really important, Bob, when we talk about climate change. The climate is changing. It doesn't mean that everything gets warmer. What it means is that you could see much greater variation in the weather that you experience. And we've built an entire infrastructure based on a past sense of what was normal and what was atypical. And we could be moving into a world, indeed we are moving into a world, where we're going to experience weather events we're not used to, and our infrastructure is not adapted to it. And I think that's one of the lessons coming out of Texas. Just one other quick thing. I think what is really significant is that point you made about GM saying it's going to go all electric. And I think that government, because of the division politically in the country, is not likely to lead the effort. I think you're seeing markets respond to what's happening and deciding where they need to be is reducing their carbon emissions. I think it's going to be driven by not just major companies, producers like General Motors, but I would imagine the insurance and reinsurance industry is going to be pushing this along. Because if you look at property losses in the United States because of weather events, it keeps going up. Some things are becoming uninsurable. I think that's going to provide some momentum. But regrettably, I think government is going to be slow to the game rather than leading. And that's a real problem because the longer you delay, the steeper the bill is going to be.
Yeah, it's a good point, Jim, on both the infrastructure front that you mentioned, and we should all keep an eye on the infrastructure proposals coming out of the Biden administration as well in this area. But also, as you say, what was happening in the private sector. It's worth noting, you know, you had no better friend to the fossil fuel industry in the United States than the Trump administration over the last 4 years. And yet, because of the forces that were underway in terms of the sort of inexorable forces moving towards cleaner energy sources, renewables, away from coal in particular, but it also must be said natural gas was a big driver as well. But in general, you had a movement where the private sector was not sort of taking up the administration on its incentives in the way that it might have expected. And yet there was this move towards renewables. So that's going to be worth watching. Jim, there's an event that has also been worth watching on an annual basis. You and I typically size up the Munich Security Conference. And like all the other ones that we've been talking about, it has gone virtual this year. Joining this year, though, is a pretty powerhouse lineup of leaders, especially in the transatlantic community. President Biden, who is a regular visitor to the conference as senator and then vice president, is due to address the meeting virtually. Can you kind of set the table for us, Jim, on what we should be expecting?
Happy to, Bob. The Munich Security Conference is sometimes referred to as the Davos for defense. It's held every February. And as you point out, because of COVID-19, they have canceled the in-person gathering. So what they're having instead is a special edition. I think it's only going to last roughly an afternoon. And it's bringing together a number of people, including the president of the United States. And on one level, that's unusual. Typically, U.S. presidents don't speak at the Munich Security Conference. But as you point out, Joe Biden, as a senator and then as a vice president, was a regular participant. And indeed, I think three times during his vice presidential years, he led the U.S. delegation to Munich to participate.
And I believe one of those, Jim, is when Biden announced the U.S.-Russia reset, such as it was in the Obama administration.
And I'll note the last time he spoke was in 2019, just before he announced his run for the presidency. And I think Biden is speaking to the Munich Security Conference, not just because he likes it and it's sort of been part of his life for a long time, but he wants to demonstrate by his actions that he means what he says when America's back. This is about providing reassurance, repeating the message to America's transatlantic friends that the United States wants to work with them on addressing common challenges and seizing mutual opportunities. Again, the bumper sticker for the Biden team on this has been America is back. The question I think he faces is everyone expects him to say that in his address, but what is he going to say beyond that? Again, I think Europeans are willing to give Biden credit for wanting to repair the damage done by the Trump presidency. They're going to give him credit for showing up. Indeed, in diplomacy, as in much of life, just being there, showing that you are interested matters. But I think what people are going to be listening to is what is Joe Biden going to say beyond that? Is he going to speak to specific issues? What is he going to offer that the United States is willing to do? What is he going to ask Europeans to do? And I think that's going to be the really interesting thing to listen to in this conversation. To what extent does Joe Biden get specific? Now, I will note there's two issues that he could talk about. One, obviously, would be to talk about the pandemic. And again, he has made addressing the pandemic job one for his domestic policy team, because getting the country back to something approximating normal is critical to everything else that he wants to do. And another thing he can talk about, obviously, is a topic we just mentioned, which is climate change, and to highlight that. But we shouldn't forget that there are also a lot of divisive issues in the transatlantic relationship, issues where even if we agree on the top line, we don't agree on the details. For example, what do you do about a more aggressive China? How do you best respond to Russia? Not just its aggression, but its internal politics, its arrest of Alexei Navalny and the rest. Lots of economic issues and divisions, particularly on issues like digital federal taxation. So again, while the transatlantic relationship may be composed of like-minded countries, it doesn't mean that they agree on priorities, on issues, or on tactics. There's plenty of division there.
And this Munich meeting is always really valuable because it was 3 or 4 days of important policymakers, not always the leaders, but a lot of times people who were the voice of their various countries' constituents, you know, getting together and doing their side meetings and so forth to talk about those types of issues, Jim, to talk about NATO. I think Afghanistan is going to be another important one. We just had defense secretaries getting together from NATO countries talking about what is the end game in Afghanistan? Does it happen this year? The Taliban's resurgence, what does that mean? What does it mean with all of these sort of people power movements going on in Europe's periphery or in eastern frontiers, Belarus, Russia, as you mentioned, but also some of the other former Soviet states? You know, to what role does the, you know, the sort of Euro-Atlantic alliance play in trying to foster those and speak to, you know, kind of shared values that they're willing to kind of act on, put behind it some support? Those are all kind of seem to be really fraying right now in ways that they weren't in the past. So that's going to be worth watching too.
You're quite right, Bob. And you put your finger on the big problem that the Biden administration faces. On the one hand, what it would like to do is keep things generic right now because it's still staffing up its national security team. They want to work through a whole variety of issues. They want to come out with a consistent, coherent plan of action. But on the other hand, they're facing a world that is continuing to move on. Events are coming up. Decisions need to be made. And they run the risk that the more generic they go, the more people are going to say, okay, but what are we going to do? On the other hand, if you start making snap decisions, you can find yourself all of a sudden having many crises in the relationship that you have to put out that detract from your desire to want to sort of think broadly and put together a coherent plan. So diplomacy is easy to talk about. It can be very hard to execute in practice. And I think the Biden team is discovering that right now. Well, Bob, it's that time of the podcast when we talk about our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala as the figure of the week. Can you tell us, Bob, why Dr. Okonjo-Iweala is the audience figure of the week?
Absolutely, Jim. Dr. Ngozi, as she sometimes likes to be known, is the first woman and first African to lead the World Trade Organization, as confirmed just this past week. And this was one of those moves that was sort of waiting on the Biden administration to take office. She was not the favorite candidate of the Trump administration, which had been supporting the South Korean candidate, Yoo Myung-hee, but Dr. Okonjo-Iweala was the consensus pick. And as the process waited out and as the Biden administration took office, Yoo withdrew from the race and the Biden administration announced its support for Dr. Okonjo-Iweala. Now, she's a well-known figure in Washington. She had been a senior official at the World Bank. She's also well-known internationally. She had, among other things, had run the Gavi vaccine program internationally. And she was also a finance minister of Nigeria, helping to navigate it through some really tough debt circumstances, among other things. She's someone who I think many supporters feel like is well-suited for the times that we're in. And she has mentioned talking about trying to galvanize support for making sure vaccines are more widely available, apropos our earlier discussion, and has experience obviously running large, complicated international organizations. And so she'll be overseeing the WTO Secretariat in Geneva. It has about 700 staff, sort of setting the tone, helping to set direction, and also obviously dealing with the number one biggest relationship or most tricky relationship at the moment, which is the United States. Certainly under the Trump administration, which had been very critical of WTO, which had sought to weaken the dispute settlement mechanism. And President Trump himself had raised questions about the viability of WTO itself. Having now a Biden administration that has pledged to recommit the U.S. towards the WTO's mission of expanding trade and trying to establish a level playing field and so forth and work multilaterally to do so, we'll see whether or not the organization is able to sort of steer global trade in a direction that had been sought by the WTO's creators.
You're quite right, Bob. One of the top challenges Dr. Okonjo-Iweala is going to face is rebuilding relations with the United States. And I'll just note the fact that the Biden administration acceded to her appointment as Director General at the World Trade Organization doesn't mean that the Biden administration has decided to move forward with allowing people to be appointed to the appellate body. As you mentioned, the appellate body and the dispute settlement mechanism of the WTO has basically been placed in limbo because of the policies of the Trump administration. Something else interesting to pay attention to in the coming weeks and months is who Dr. Ocasio-Iweala appoints to the critical positions of deputy director generals at the WTO. I think there's four or five of them. They rotate out. She gets to pick her own team. And there's a lot of balancing that goes on because obviously everyone starts to look at the nationalities of those people who are appointed as deputy director generals and what position they take. So that's going to be something to keep our eye on. She is going to have her hands full, not just because there are a lot of trade issues, but because her relations with one of the most important stakeholders, the United States, is so troubled. And to the extent that she rebuilds relations with Washington, she runs the risk of creating fissures with Beijing. So it'll be a big test of her diplomatic skills.
And I would just note our colleague John Campbell has written on his blog about Dr. Ocasio-Iweala, and among other things, noting the important symbolism of having a woman and an African in this position, especially among developing nations, but not to overlook her skills and her very real talents. And Ambassador Campbell, who's a very close watcher of Nigeria, is, I think, well familiar with what she was able to achieve there. So it's going to be interesting to see how she's able to navigate.
That's true, Bob.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Niger holds presidential runoff elections, and UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson chairs a UN Security Council debate on climate and security.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Anna Shortley and Bethany Wright for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collis. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.